possibly. This is, I'm looking at one of the first of four books.
Or maybe you have some elements.
Can you not talk if possible? No. I'll start again. I'm looking at the first of four books from my graduate student research period within Sandy Ogston's lab. It begins, interestingly enough, with a circuit for a thermostat. That's quite surprising to a modern-day scientist that one would have to build one's own thermostat to control the water bath. But my first job was to make this circuit. I was quite familiar with electronic circuits. Well, electronic perhaps is a modern word, but they were tube circuits or valve circuits, because as a child I'd been making radios for a long time. In fact, there was a rather enjoyable period during World War II when I was a teenager, that we were required to carry gas masks in a box, a cardboard box about 6 inches tall and maybe 8 inches wide and 5 inches deep, and I made a radio to fit in my gas mask box. So I didn't have a gas mask. I had a little one tube radio in the gas box, in the gas mask box. But anyway, so I was well familiar with circuits, and this was not a surprise to me to have to start by making building a thermostat, the electronic part of a thermostat. It's the main part of the diagram is in ink, but there are various additions on the side because the circuit also had to be able to have the ability to control the motor for the stirrer and also a subsidiary heater, so that the main heat was on all the time, but the thermostat just controlled the additional heat needed to get to the final temperature. And there are the details there. And on the second page is how I set out the circuit on a board with motor resistance and a 40-watt lamp and the tube, the vacuum tube KT71, and the heater mains resistance, etc. It's all set up. The note that the motor supply is on the separate switch from the main switch, but supplied by the same plug from the mains. All other supply to the thermostat passes through the main switch. Heaters and regulator have additional series switches. And then there's a blank page where presumably I made the circuit. And that already, October 11th, 48, I'm rather surprised to see that I already have osmotic measurements there. So I must have been beginning to measure osmotic pressure already. I don't remember what particular apparatus I was using at that time, but I do know that the final machine or the final instrument that I made was quite complicated, and I don't know whether where notebooks are, if they exist, detail its construction. My thesis has those details, and I think I'll stop this recording of this book and go back to my thesis before continuing this book, because it doesn't make much sense without having the details of what the apparatus was. So I'll stop here. I don't have a very good record of the experimental part of my thesis work in the form of a notebook, but I have a good account in the thesis itself, and it's necessary to look at that a little in order to understand what was going on. The thesis itself is divided in essentially into two parts. The one part being a rather complicated set of calculations and derivations of equations to describe the osmotic pressure of solutions and correct for the interaction between protein solutions and the surrounding electrolytes, in this case sodium chloride, and so forth. I know now that the theoretical section has a serious error in it, because when I tried to write this up for publication after I had finished my thesis and was a postdoctoral fellow in the University of Wisconsin, I had a very good roommate in the laboratory, a laboratory roommate in Wisconsin, Dick Goldberg, who was a fine theoretical physical chemist. And when I attempted to write up the theoretical part of my thesis, I found that I've made an assumption somewhere in the thesis of saying a certain term was negligible. It turned out that the term that I neglected was approximately equal in magnitude to the term that I later was considering as theoretically important, which basically made that all of the theoretical part of the thesis was pretty well faulty. So nowhere is this is the theoretical part published in the scientific literature. The experimental part was published because the measurements were of high precision. The measurements of osmotic pressure, that is, were of high precision, and the method was interesting, though it has a rather sad history, in the sense that although the work took 2 years to accomplish experimentally, and I enjoyed this very much, and published it, nobody ever quoted the paper for the method, and nobody ever used the method subsequently, and I never used the method subsequently. So I often tell students that here is an example of a thesis problem which has a record of never being quoted by anyone and never being used by anyone, but having taught me how to do good experimental science and enjoying it. So that was the point of the experimental part of the thesis. So in many ways, the thesis is completely unimportant. Nonetheless, it's interesting to look at it and see how, you might say, not dedicated, but compulsive behavior of Smithies in trying to get things to several decimal places of precision when other people had them at a much lower level of precision. So it is worth looking at the experimental part of the thesis first, because it makes some sense of the recorded observations which are in four experimental books, 1 through 4, that I'll talk about later. So let's go back to the thesis and look at the experimental part of the thesis. I'll experimental part of the thesis begins on page 51, talking about the experimental work falls mainly into three, naturally into three main sections. Preparation of lactoglobulin, the protein that was being studied, the estimation of its concentration by refractometry, and the measurement of the osmotic pressure as the third section. So the first part is talking about the preparation of lactoglobulin, which is also part comes repeatedly in the notebooks that I have, 1 through 4, and we'll talk about later. So it starts off on page 52 by talking about the preparation of lactoglobulin solution by a method described by Cecil, Rupert Cecil, and Oxton, Sandy Oxton, with a few minor modifications, starting typically, in this case, May 31st in 1950, with 2 gallons of milk direct from the milking sheds, remembering that you could, in Oxford, as anywhere else, you could go to a farm and get somebody to give you milk. Straightforward, getting rid of the cream and then precipitating the casein with ammonium sulfate and so on. So starting on May 31st, by June 4th, I've got 2 to 5 cc's of oil present in the dialysis sac, because the dialysis was needed to get rid of the ammonium sulfate used to precipitate the casein, and so on. And then the June 5th, the oily material and supernatant were removed from the dialysis sac and put into the refrigerator. And next day, the preparation was seeded with crystalline lactoglobulin, which is interesting. So I had crystalline lactoglobulin available from previous experiments of other people, of Cecil and Oxton, and I used that to seed the material that I had. And the crystallization was complete the next day. And so it goes on and describes that. And then solutions of lactoglobulin were made in fairly concentrated sodium chloride, 1.19 molal sodium chloride, which was a theoretical concentration that was the outcome of the error-prone calculations made in the theoretical part, but it was a high concentration of salt. And I made some solutions of 0.5%, 1%, 2%, 4%, 6%, 8%, and 10%, and they were dialyzed against a buffer in all at the same time. And they were rotated in this solution, and then the proteins were freeze dried. The crystalline protein was freeze dried, remembering it had been dialyzed against distilled water, so it didn't have any salt in it anymore. It was freeze dried by a rather complicated apparatus. That is described and diagrammed. Then, going further on, I did various tests on the material that I'd freeze-dried, and came to the conclusion that the freeze-dried material is not sensibly altered by the drying, so that I don't know what I did to make that statement. I was really concerned in making the protein crystals free from water, and an apparatus was used to get them really, the crystals really dry, so I could measure their concentration. And I must have known from other people's work that it was possible to dry crystallized beta 2 lactoglobulin without it being denatured. That's rather unusual. And I do remember doing tests where I, after it had been dried, I heated it to 105 degrees, as I remember, to make sure that it was dry, and it still was perfectly soluble in water in a salt solution thereafter. So it was very stable protein. Yeah, I even made a special dish for drying things in. And then I was a bit, you might say, not frustrated, but didn't like the method of dialysis, so I tried to make an electrolytic, an electrodialyzer that would take out salt by passing an electric current instead of mechanical. So I make the comment that the mechanical dialyzer was used for most of the work designed by Oxton, which enabled the dialysis sac to be spun in clockwise and anti-clockwise, and therefore mixing inside while the dialysis was taking place. But for reasons that I mentioned later in the thesis, I wanted lactoglobulin completely free from salt. And so I tried an electrodialyzer made out of Perspex. I liked making things, and so I didn't have any trouble making this apparatus to control the removal of salt by electrolysis, and have diagrams of the flowing water through the machine while the electrolysis was occurring at the same time. Fairly awkward machine, but I enjoyed doing it. And I measured the current during the procedure, so I could get an idea that I'd got rid of all the salt, because initially there was quite a large milliampere current going through the machine, but as it was washed out by the flow of liquid, the current through the machine decreased more and more and washed out. So that the final solution was essentially free from any salt. Not satisfied with the arrangement of the water circulation in the machine, I messed around with that and have several pages describing the direction of flow of these, of the liquid in the electrodialyzer. I'm sure not really very important, but it was a sort of compulsion compulsive behaviour of Smithies in trying to understand the experiments always and improve them. Then we go to the section on measuring the concentration of the lactoglobulin by an optical system. This is a system that was had already been described originally by Philpott, John Philpott, who was one of Sandy's earlier students. I think he might have been a contemporary of Sandy's rather than his student, but it had been designed and made by Sandy Oxton and Rupert Cecil, and it was their machine slightly modified to enable more accurate determinations to be made when the solutions were concentrated. And so it was a fairly sophisticated machine for measuring refractive index, because you could you had a very fine slit and an image of the slit, and then with a couple of lenses, the optical path through the refractometer combined again to give an image where the slit dia. The slit image was now a pattern that could be measured. The diagrams are fairly self-explanatory. It's a little difficult to verbalize it. But I was convinced that it could be made very accurate, and was writing down deflections and concentrations with four decimal places, 0.3599, 0.3599, at different times, 0.3599, three measurements on page 78, and then the blank was set up, and the deflection was then 0.0187 twice. So I was getting things reproducible to four decimals. Yeah, quite nice. For example, the blank was a measurement, but in practice it was found that this value was sufficiently constant to make it unnecessary to determine the blank every time, because the variation was less than the accuracy that I was aiming for, which was plus or minus 0.1%. Then I have the section beginning on page 82 on the measurement of the osmotic pressure, and it just shows a general solution initially of having an external pressure on the higher on the I'm looking at this, I'll backtrack on that. Page 82, two solutions are being talked about. What's surprising me is that it's talking about a pressure on one side A and a pressure on the other side B, and so the pressure B being the side where the protein solution is, and the side A being the side where the solvent is, this sodium chloride solution, and that PB would have to be greater than PA to oppose the osmotic pressure due to the concentration of water in the protein solution being lower than the concentration of water in the solvent. And it just sets up a few little equations indicating that you also have to worry about the surface tension of the solutions, because the surface tension of water is different from the surface tension of a protein solution. Porsche remote. The surface tension, I tried adding material to coat the tubes, but it didn't really alter the surface tension. I tried a substance called Tedol and silicon varnish, which is a silicone varnish, but it didn't really alter the surface tension. I didn't reduce it to zero. And another type of tubing, Viridia. So I have an example of Viridia tubing. So on, concerning myself about the osmotic, about the surface tension. In the end, the solution was really quite simple. I made a very thin latex, you might say a condom, and attached this to the bottom of the of my machine and allowed it to collapse, and it was very thin, so that it essentially imposed no pressure difference between the inside and the outside, and I was able to directly measure the osmotic pressure using tubes that were in the final apparatus. Page 89 shows this machine. A collapsed impermeable rubber sack is what I used to call it. My fellow students didn't refer to it in that way. They call it a rubber Johnny, is an expression for it. And it required making rather nice sacks of this sort. It's quite a bit of effort in making them. There's one page on page 93, the sacks so produced were beautifully clear and uniform, but showed pinholes when distended with about 15 millilitres of water. The pinholes were removed by double coating. So coat the glass rod, dry for half an hour, coat, dry for half an hour, and then steam 10 minutes and wash thoroughly. And these sacks made with latex partly diluted were a little thick. The most dilute latex which could be used was a nice 4.5 mils of water, of latex to one of water, and this gave four sacks free from any leaks out of six that were made, and you had to steam them. So I was quite involved in making these sacks, and I determined the collapse pressure of these rubber sacks, because as I said, I assumed they had no difference in pressure between the collapsed sack and a little more collapse versus a little less collapse, and I found that the difference in pressure on the two sides was an average of about 0.015 millimeters of water, which was smaller than the error that I was prepared to accept, which was 0.1 milliliter of water. So that they didn't have any problem. It's clear that with an allowance of approximately 0.015 centimeters for the collapse pressure of the rubber sack, this U-tube method can be used to give a direct correction for surface tension errors present in the osmometer. And then the experiment of actually measuring the surface tension of the different solutions of lactoglobulin, 0.5%, 1%, 2%, 6%, 8%, and 10% is listed. And a rather nice graph of surface tension correction And the maximum still being only about 0.2 millimetres, 0.2 centimetres of water, but with a good correction available. So I was happy with being able to correct for surface tension differences. And then the next thing was the preparation of the semi-permeable membranes themselves. These are membranes made out of collodion, which is, I think, a cellulose acetate, if I remember rightly. It might have been a different form of cellulose, but you could get a solution of this and then coat a glass rod or whatever and allow it to dry, and you get a thin membrane of basically of reconstituted cellulose. Or a cellulose derivative. And so I have this statement on page 102 that the dynamic osmometer used in this work required the preparation of membranes as permeable as possible to water and sodium chloride, but completely impermeable to lactoglobulin, and how to make them. And I tried different methods to make them, trying to use something on which they could be formed on the attached to the apparatus, because they would be too fragile to insert onto the machine, onto the osmometer, but have to be made in situ. And I tried various things. I tried a former made out of Wood's metal, which is a metal that melts at 70 degrees. But eventually I found out that sodium thiosulfate could be used. It's rather an interesting substance. If you warm it, it melts in its own water of crystallization. So sodium thiosulfate, I don't remember how many molecules of water per a molecule of sodium thiosulfate, something like 10, and when you warm it up, it will dissolve in its own water of crystallization, but when it cools again, it sets into a solid. And I was able to make tubes, these thin membranes, by having a layer of thiosulfate and seeding the layer of thiosulfate solution with a crystal at the bottom, so that the crystals formed beautifully uniformly, and they could be made round and pretty. And there is on page 107 a little diagram showing how to take off the plastic tube that was used to contain the thiosulfate, and it's a thumbnail being used, and my co-graduate students used to enjoy this because they called it a thumbnail sketch, and it was really a sketch of a thumbnail on page 107 of the thesis. So a thumbnail sketch really is a thumbnail sketch, making those crystals. But they were quite nice, because when once made, those membranes, you could easily see if they had a leak, because the sodium thiosulfate was high concentration, and as you washed out the sodium thiosulfate out of the thin membrane, if there was a hole in the membrane, you could see the thiosulfate coming out by refractive index, so you could observe any leaks. So it was quite possible to make very good membranes that way. And then I have making of a constant water, constant temperature water bath, which is actually the first page of my notebooks, where the circuit diagram of the constant temperature water bath is given. So page 114 of my thesis talks about the solution, the circuit diagram of the constant temperature bath that is the beginning of, is the first page of book one of my experimental notes. So it begins, the experimental notes begin in a sense after all of the experimental procedure was worked out. So that's why I have had to go over the thesis bit by bit, otherwise the other part of the machine is not understandable. And it was the dynamic osmometer means that I was using it in such a way that I could tell whether the pressure on the protein side was too high, in which case liquid would flow from the protein solution into the solution of the dialysis solution, so liquid would flow from the protein side to the solvent side, and if the pressure was too low, liquid would flow from the solvent side into the protein side. And I followed this by using a fine capillary with a little oily droplet in the capillary, which could be observed with a telescope, and one could then vary the pressure and find out what the pressure was when there was zero flow by having first a positive flow and a negative flow and drawing a line between them, and where it crossed zero is the actual pressure. It was highly sophisticated and quite unimportant. To know the pressure accurately that I was applying, and that was done with attached to the system was a manometer with bromo CHBr3 on one side and mercury on the bottom, and the pressure could be altered by a control knob. And the pressure difference was measured by looking at the manometer. So page 128 of the thesis shows on the left-hand side the osmometer itself, and the middle diagram is the surface tension apparatus, and on the right-hand side is the diagram of the manometer itself. And all these were highly precision made glass constructs, which were made in those days by the glass blowers in the department. It was so important to be able to make glass things that the Department of Biochemistry, in which this work was being done, had professionals who would make anything you wanted out of glass. So all the apparatus was actually made by professional glass blowers, and it was a rather beautiful stuff. The diagram on page 128 is well worth looking at. Details, incredibly detailed, of using the apparatus. Really quite amazing to look at to me now. But the final result is shown in later. But an example of where the thermostat temperature was varying is given on page 142, where one can see that the applied pressure it changes for getting zero flow because the thermostat was not set correctly. And then the real results are presented on page 145, where all the theoretical, where the osmotic pressures are measured to two decimal places in centimetres of water. 7.04 was the lowest osmotic pressure, and the highest was 91.51. And these are all recorded to two decimal places of precision. And the refractometer measurements are again four decimals, and meaning 0.1% plus or minus 0.1%. And the data are therefore with a precision of the order of 0.1%. And the points are the experiment points are so close together that it's not possible to draw a line through them without covering the points up. So the final publication had to interrupt the theoretical line to show the experimental point. I was very proud of it, quite rightly, for precision, but as far as usefulness in science, only useful to me as good training to do experiments. So the apparatus is made and it's calibrated, and we can turn now to the actual record of the osmotic pressure. So book one starts off with a diagram of the circuit diagram for the thermostat, and I think I've talked a little bit about that already in the recording. I won't go over that again. But then from there on, there are just a series of actual measurements. So though the pages are not numbered, the first page after the diagram for the thermostat circuit is measuring osmotic pressures. So I began to measure osmotic pressures on October 11th, 1948. And the protein level was so and such, and the buffer level was so and such, and from it I measure the osmotic pressure. And the note, the collodion news was made by A.G. Oxton, was what was called pyroxylin, 3%, ethanol, 40%, ether, 60%, and ethylene glycol, 3 cc's, presumably per 100 mils. Membrane was made by a single coat, dried for 6 minutes in the vertical desiccator, tested with TCA. I don't know what TCA is here. On buffer showed slight protein permeability. Repeat and dry the membrane for 12 minutes. So membranes dried for 12 minutes showed very small or zero protein permeability. TCA must have mean that I tested whether I put a high pressure on the protein side, collected the material going through it, and precipitated with tricarboxylic acid, with trichloroacetic acid, to see if there was any protein coming through, and worked in that way to get the membranes impermeable. For example, on November 8th, I said the membrane made 2 days ago with collodion 1A twice degassed, was doubly coated and tested with a hemoglobin preparation, and it shows whether there was any permeability. So I'm making good membranes. And here's an example. Repeat the experiment with the apparatus, and a leak developed in the water bath. I don't know how that was possible. As it says, a leak developed. I'm looking at hemoglobin solutions at the moment, so just testing things out with hemoglobin rather than with lactoglobulin. 3.1% hemoglobin, doubly coated a membrane, and measuring what's happening to the movement of my little droplet in the osmometer. I didn't like the droplets I was using, that it tended to be not round, but was, I say, used chlorobenzene to reduce the flattening of the droplet. I don't remember whether the final one was chlorobenzene or not. I have an idea that it was something different, but it's recorded in the paper. I tried experiments with a sack empty of protein. So I measured the osmotic pressure by having a little potassium chloride on one side of the membrane versus water on the other side of the membrane, and I have 5 centimeters osmotic pressure initially, and then in 4 minutes it's down to 3.5, in 12 minutes it's down to 1.8, in 30 minutes it's down to 0.5 centimeters. So I decided from this, I worked out that the solution would come to equilibrium with a half-life of 8 minutes, so that if the apparatus was set up in the morning and or in the afternoon and one waited until next day, the solutions would all be at equilibrium as far as salt was concerned, so that this was part of the comment once made about the apparatus, that it was in the literature, which was that it was, I guess there must have been one place that just described it as not working very well. It said that the apparatus required waiting overnight to come to equilibrium, and which is in the thesis here. So somebody did actually comment on the method, but nobody ever used it. Fresh hemoglobin here on one page, 9.1 centimeters of osmotic pressure. Here I am getting used to the method. And then, as always, throughout these notes on the experiment, every now and then there is a making a new preparation of lactoglobulin. So 1-12-48, the 12th of January 1948, making recrystallizing lactoglobulin again. Buffer made for lactoglobulin, osmotic pressure made, preparation of stock lactoglobulin, and then osmotic pressures, and so on. Thinning the membrane seemed a great improvement. Conditions for making the formers and the membrane, the sodium thiosulfate membranes. Clean and dry the glass parts and the polyethylene tube, assemble with a small crystal, prepare iced water, heat the thiosulfate, boil off a little of the water, allow it to cool to about 80 degrees centigrade, and then pour into the polyethylene, place in position, immerse the lower end in iced water, and let the crystals come. And finally, as the crystals approach halfway, fully immerse it in the water. Very detailed description of how to make these the crystal former on which the semi-permeable membranes were made. With a comment on the next page, that the 10-minute membrane, early type pyroxylin, etc., used, etc., and with a big comment that does not leak. Then some more making new collodion solutions to make these membranes, and so on it goes. Pages and pages of detailed work on trying to measure these osmotic pressures. Well, here's a previous preparation left overnight, no sign of a leak, mixed and repeated. And a comment here that is quite clear that leakage, if any, is very slight. However, a used membrane tested at 10 centimetres of mercury with protein solution, the filtrate gave very slightly positive tests for protein with trichloroacetic acid, and it even determined the bursting pressure of the membrane was 52 centimetres of mercury, so they could send quite a big pressure. A 20-minute membrane was made and tested at 17 centimetres of mercury, and that was 52 centimetres of mercury, not of water, so that would be 500 centimetres of water or thereabout. So a 20-minute membrane made and tested at 17 centimetres of mercury with protein. A complete absence of cloudiness, that's trichloroacetic acid cloudiness, after ultrafiltration of about 0.3 to 0.5 cubic centimetres of filtrate. And here's a measurement of osmotic pressure now, 12.18, following day. Close the door on the windows, I was concerned about temperature varying. Here's an example left over the weekend, at slightly too low a pressure, mixed and repeated. Another lactoglobulin preparation, starting with 7.2 litres of separated milk. Capillary measurements, surface tension, and so on to the end of that book. Nothing very striking. So here I'm cleaning the apparatus with various things. And in this particular case, remove the silicone with aqua regia, 1 to 2 hours of boiling. Incredible to think of doing that. And then with dilute sodium hydroxide and water to clean the apparatus, to get rid of the grease that had been introduced in previous runs. So we'd use extremely harsh methods to clean the apparatus. And a test of the electrodialyzer that I talked about on the 25th of March 1949. inclusions are there. The majority of sodium chloride carried out by the current, increase the current by stepping up the voltage, etc., etc. And wanted to see there wasn't any hyperchlorite made there, so I tested for whether there was any OCl minus made. So I redesigned the flow because I didn't like what the pattern that I could see. Flow system was changed. Comments on the freeze drying machine. Again, how to freeze dry the protein, as it referred to in the thesis. And the this book ends with dismantled and cleaned again more extensively, reassembled, etc., etc. And that's where this book ends. Book one.